Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Thursday, December 31st. I'm Maddie Ryan, and my partner at the microphone for the next 30 minutes is Linda Lundgren. For the first hour, we will read state and local news from the Des Moines Register, along with selections from USA Today. We'll continue with news for another 30 minutes, then change readers. Our second shift will start with the opinion pages. Obituaries will be read at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., followed by sports. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby and a weather recap. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. IRIS provides our 24/7 services and equipment to our listeners at no cost. If you would like to learn more about how you can help keep us the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong, give us a call at 515-243-6833 or visit iowaradioreading.org. Now we'll take a look at the weather and the headlines featured in today's paper. Today we'll have a high of 36 with a low of 22, clouds and sun today, winds from the south-southeast at 6 to 12 miles per hour. It'll be mainly clear tonight with the winds lowering down to 4 to 8 miles per hour. Looking to Friday, we'll have the same high of 36, a low of 7 with clouds and sun. Saturday looks like the day to be wary of. It's going to be a high of 8 degrees, a low of negative 9 with snow that could accumulate to 4 to 8 inches. So I'm sure everyone will be keeping their eye out on that. Featured on the front page is a continuing article feature called 2022 People to Watch. This week we have Karen Schaefer. The headline reads, Life's a Stage for Girls Weekend Playwright. Next headline, COVID-19 cases tick up, but hospitalizations drop from heights. And the last front page article is Tsunami Feared. WHO Chief Worries Variant Will Pressure Healthcare Systems. Over to Linda for our first story.
Well, I'll read the story of People to Watch for this week. Life's a Stage for Girls Weekend Playwright. Karen Schaefer wrote funny roles she couldn't find. Karen Schaefer was 49 when she decided to write her first play. While maintaining her day job at Iowa PBS, she blazed through her first full-length script, Girls Weekend, in about 2 weeks. The play has since been performed across the country and abroad and has a sequel in the works. I decided that I was really unhappy with the parts that were being created for women in my age group, said Schaefer. The roles that were coming out were like mom roles or quirky aunt roles. I'd go in and audition and they'd say, you don't look like a mom. She said she thought to herself, okay, you can either complain about it or you can do something about it. She started writing and in 2 weeks completed a first draft of Girls Weekend. The comedy follows four Iowa women as they spend a weekend in the woods, drinking wine and talking about books before a wrench is thrown into the weekend with the arrival of their romantic partners. This results in a cavalcade of physical comedy and humor of the sort Schaefer, now 60, wished she found more readily in scripts. Raised on the humor of the Three Stooges, Bugs Bunny, and the Marx Brothers, Schaefer sought to create roles for women in that vein of comedy. 7 years since the Des Moines World premiere of that original romantic comedy, Schaefer has penned more than half a dozen other scripts, including the soon-to-be-staged sequel to Girls Weekend. She remains prolific with two new scripts headed to stages in 2022, and three others continuing to find new audiences worldwide, making her one of the Des Moines Register's 15 people to watch in 2022. The Texas-born Schaefer started performing in the theater at age 11. In a way, it's what led her to Des Moines, since she met her husband, local actor and radio personality Max Schaefer, while participating in community theater in Victoria, Texas. He convinced her to move to Iowa, and when she started writing Girls Weekend, he gave her candid feedback. "Can I be honest?" he asked her after reading it, the Register reported in 2014. "It's a really, really funny play, but it needs some work. You have to hear somebody reading it. You have to get an editor, somebody you trust." Schaefer would end up working with Kathy Pingle, director of the first Girls Weekend and the forthcoming Girls Weekend 2, as part of her writing process, with Pingle offering edits and critiques. Schaefer also managed to get a reading of the script at the Des Moines Playhouse, which resulted in the Girls Weekend being added to the venue's main season in 2014. The theater group typically reads through several plays once a month, with actors invited in to read parts. More than 150 people showed up for this reading. John Viers, who was the artistic director for the Playhouse at the time, basically committed at that moment to put it on the main stage. "And I think that was because of the electricity in the room," said Pingle, recalling an early reading for the first Girls Weekend. When it debuted, Girls Weekend was the first fully original production staged at the Playhouse since From the Window, The World of Anne Frank, in 1998 by another local writer, Cynthia Mercati. The play went on to be published through Dramatic Publishing, based in Woodstock, Illinois, in 2017 at the urging of members of the Des Moines theater scene. "It actually went to Dramatic Publishing and they first turned it down," Pingle said. Rod McCullough, who was the managing director at the Playhouse, called them up and said, "You need to take another look at this." Dramatic Publishing went on to accept the script. Matthew McIver, artistic director of Iowa Stage Theater Company, said it was an impressive feat to write a quality farce, which tend to be technically and physically demanding, as a first play. He said he wholeheartedly believes that the sequel to Girls Weekend is one of the best comedies to hit the stage. "To write a good farce at all is very rare, and to write a good farce that's funny is the needle in a haystack kind of rare," McIver said. "As a debut play, it's remarkable on a lot of levels." Schaefer's writing career took off from there, with five plays performed in five different venues for the 2021-22 theater season. Iowa Stage Theater Company plans to debut Girls Weekend 2, which brings back the characters and cast members of its predecessor. The play opens April 29, 2022 in downtown Des Moines Stoner Theater, with performances through May 15. In 2021, Schaefer was among a handful of playwrights to have an original piece staged as part of the American Association of Community Theater New Play Fest 2022, a biennial contest focused on staging and publishing new work. Her play, Unpacking Mother, which follows two sisters sorting through the effects of their recently deceased mom, will have its world premiere at the Market House Theater in Paducah, Kentucky, just 2 months before Girls Weekend 2 takes the stage in Des Moines. Karen, in a very short span of time, has covered a large range of styles, tones, genres, said McIver, who's also booked Schaefer for ISTC's Scriptees Play Readings, a series that focuses on new plays from Iowa writers. When MacGyver heard that Girls' Weekend 2 was in the works, he quickly secured the world premiere for his theater company. Once able to go through the script for himself, he was elated to find Girls' Weekend 2 worked as a strong and funny play on its own. As an artistic director, it's very hard to find comedies, and it's very hard to find great comedies, MacGyver told the Register in November. And to find great comedies that are funny is pretty much the Holy Grail. Girls' Weekend 2 brings back the same cast that debuted the original. The plot starts with an upcoming wedding, spurring those familiar characters to host an epic bachelorette party at the cabin seen in the first play. The years between the original production and the follow-up have not dampened the enthusiasm of its participants. For me, it's a chance to hone a skill that I know I probably have. I just haven't really gotten a chance to use it, said returning performer Becky Scholtek of the more slapstick scenes her character, Meg, acts out in the sequel. She decided to move back an elective surgery originally scheduled in March so she could perform the part. As a Des Moines resident for most of her life, Schaefer attributes her growing resume of plays to people like Scholtek and Pingle, MacGyver, and Viers, current and former Central Iowans who read her work and became willing to fight for it. I can't do what I do anywhere else in the country because of the generosity of Iowans, Schaefer said. And a little bit about Karen. She's 60. She lives in Des Moines. She was educated at the Texas State University. In her career, she was executive secretary to Molly Phillips at Iowa PBS. And her family? She has two adult children, Alex and John Schaefer, with her husband, Max Schaefer. And then a little bit about the Register's 2022 People to Watch. It has become a Register tradition to close out each year and open the next by introducing readers to 15 people to watch, individuals expected to make an impact on Iowa in the coming year. This year's nominations from readers and our journalists totaled nearly 70 people and posed hard decisions for staff members charged with winnowing them to just 15. The final 15 include people in business and the arts, those who work with small children and climb mountains, those who argue for a living, and those who deliver much-needed care. We hope that you are as inspired by reading about them as we were in profiling them.
All right. Thank you, Linda. Up next, we have COVID-19 cases tick up, but hospitalizations drop from heights. Iowa sees second highest number of new cases since late September. This comes from Nick Coltrane of the Register. Iowa has so far not seen the sharp spike in COVID-19 cases gripping much of the country, but the number of new cases in the past week again surges past 11,000. The second highest number of reported infections in that time frame since late September. The most recent figures cover the Christmas holiday, but don't necessarily include people who were able to score a rapid at-home test that showed a positive case of the disease. The number of people hospitalized with the disease in Iowa has dropped from recent heights. The 711 hospitalized COVID-19 patients reported as part of the Wednesday update by the Iowa Department of Public Health is the lowest it has been since the November 24th update, when 623 COVID-19 patients were in Iowa's hospitals. The sustained drop in cases comes after Iowa hospitalizations set a 2021 record for COVID-19 hospitalizations. On December 13th, the state reported the most recent high point in concurrent hospitalizations of 843. The coronavirus Omicron variant wave that has slammed the southern and mid-Atlantic states, as well as the Great Lakes states, hasn't yet swept through the Midwest states, including Iowa, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The extremely transmittable Omicron variant, as CDC Director Rochelle Walensky described it Wednesday, consisted about 28% of all new cases in Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska between December 19th and December 25th, the most recent data published. Nationally, the new variant accounted for about 58.6% of new cases, according to the CDC. Earlier, the CDC had estimated Omicron was responsible for even more cases nationally. Nationwide, the new variant has spurred a record number of new infections, though it's unclear how severe Omicron is compared to the previous dominant Delta variant. According to a USA Today analysis, there were more than three cases every second for the first time of the pandemic, with about 1.86 million cases reported in the seven-day period ending Tuesday. The previous record for new cases in a single week was set on January 11th, when 1.76 million new cases were set. While our cases have substantially increased from last week, hospitalizations and deaths remain comparatively low right now, Walensky said of the Omicron surge. This could be due to the fact that hospitalizations tend to lag behind cases by about 2 weeks, but may also be due to early indications that we've seen from other countries like South Africa and the United Kingdom of milder diseases from Omicron, especially among the vaccinated and boosted. In Iowa, the number of fully vaccinated people again ticked up about a third of a percentage point to about 55.8% of the total population, according to state data. The number of fully vaccinated Iowans to have received a booster shot increased by about 50,000 since last week, to amount to 810,000 people, or about a quarter of the state's total population. That equals about a quarter of the state's people are fully vaccinated and have a booster shot. On December 23rd, Unity Point Health released a video of healthcare workers pleading for people to take the free COVID-19 vaccines. In it, the workers describe the ongoing death they're seeing and their exhaustion from caring for sick patients in overstretched hospitals. Unvaccinated people make up the vast majority of the hospitalized for COVID-19 in Iowa. In the state, 83% of COVID-19 patients in the state intensive care units are not fully vaccinated. Among all COVID-19 patients in Iowa, it dips slightly to 80.6% according to state data. Those figures include 10 children ages 11 and younger in the hospital with COVID-19 and 6 children 12 to 17 years old, none of whom were fully vaccinated according to data. There are 56 hospitalized COVID-19 patients aged 18 to 35, 52 of whom were not fully vaccinated. People aged 60 to 69 are the largest demographic group in Iowa hospitals with COVID-19, with 193 patients in that age group, and nearly 80% of them are not fully vaccinated.
The third article on the front page has just a little excerpt of an article further in the paper, so I'm going to read the full article. Possible tsunami has the World Health Organization chief concerned. Not enough known about the Omicron variant yet. The head of the World Health Organization said Wednesday that he's worried about the Omicron and Delta variants of COVID-19 producing a, quote, tsunami of cases between them. But he's still hopeful that the world will put the worst of the pandemic behind it in 2022. 2 years after the coronavirus emerged, top officials with the UN Health Agency cautioned that it's still too early to be reassured by initial data suggesting that Omicron, the latest variant, leads to milder disease. First reported last month in southern Africa, it is already the dominant variant in the United States and parts of Europe. And after 92 of the World Health Organization's 194 member countries missed a target to vaccinate 40% of their populations by the end of this year, Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus urged everyone to make a New Year's resolution to get behind a campaign to vaccinate 70% of countries' populations by the beginning of July. According to WHO's figures, the number of COVID-19 cases recorded worldwide increased by 11% last week compared with the previous week, with nearly 4.99 million newly reported on December 20th to 26th. New cases in Europe, which accounted for more than half of the total, were up 3%, while those in the Americas rose 39%, and there was a 7% increase in Africa. The global gain followed a gradual increase since October. I'm highly concerned that Omicron, being more transmissible and circulating at the same time as Delta, is leading to a tsunami of cases, Tedros said at an online news conference. That, he said, will put immense pressure on exhausted health workers and health systems on the brink of collapse. WHO said in its weekly epidemiological report that the overall risk related to Omicron remains very high. It cited consistent evidence that it has a growth advantage over the Delta variant. It noted that a decline in case incidence has been seen in South Africa, and that early data from that country, the UK and Denmark, suggests a reduced risk of hospitalization with Omicron. But he said that more data is needed. WHO's emergencies chief, Dr. Michael Ryan, underlined that note of caution. He said it will be important in coming weeks to suppress transmission of both variants to the minimum that we can. Ryan said that Omicron infections began largely among young people, but what we haven't seen is the Omicron wave fully established in the broader population, and I'm a little nervous to make positive predictions until we see how well the vaccine protection is going to work in those older and more vulnerable populations. WHO officials didn't offer specific comments on decisions by the U.S. and other countries to reduce self-isolation periods. Ryan said that these are judgment calls that countries make, taking into account scientific, economic, and other factors. He noted that the average incubation period to date has been around 5 to 6 days. We need to be careful about changing tactics and strategies immediately on the basis of what we're seeing about Omicron, Ryan said.
All right, I have turned over to the Metro and Iowa section of the Register today. First up, we have Iowa State student remembered for faith, passion for weather. Hundreds turn out to say farewell to Avery Anderson. This comes from Philip Setter of the Ames Tribune. The Lutheran Church in Atlantic, Iowa, where an Iowa State University student who died in a car crash 2 days before Christmas was a member posted on social media, was a member posted on social media the day of his visitation. Each person is giving the gift of time on this earth to live, to learn, to love, and to leave a legacy. While the one-line message didn't specifically mention the late Avery Anderson, it seemed fitting, as people turned out in numbers that surprised even Anderson's parents, to remember and honor their son's life, learning, love, and legacy, including as a man of faith, an avid cyclone fan, and a chaser of cyclones and other extreme weather events. Anderson, 20, died December 23rd after his car lost traction on a frost-covered road about a mile from his home in Atlantic and rolled into a ditch. Anderson was a member of Atlantic High School's class of 2019, studying meteorology at Iowa State, and a lifelong member of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Atlantic. His mother, Sue Anderson, said the church was set up to accommodate 400 people for her son's funeral Tuesday, and that church was full. She and her husband, Steve Anderson, Avery's father, said members of their son's fraternity, youth from the church, members of Bible camp he worked at, and some of his fellow Atlantic High School alumni also volunteered to sing at the service without being asked. In addition to his visitation the day before, friends had gathered for a candlelight vigil at the church the night of Avery's death, and Steve said the church was full then as well. He and his wife recalled after the funeral service that their son would want to be remembered for and what they hope. Okay, this is just a very confusing little paragraph. I'm going to reread it. He and his wife recalled after the funeral service what their son would want to be remembered for and what they hope he's remembered for. Avery's obituary notes he was born in an ice storm on February 24th, 2001, during the state wrestling tournament in Des Moines. Steve explained he was working for a radio station covering the tournament and had been live on the air before he got the call from Sue informing him that her water had broken while at their hotel. He said he dropped his headphones and was out the door, beating Sue and a friend who was with her to the hospital after what Sue described as a very slow and scary trip. She said what really started Avery's interest in weather, though, was the summer of 2004 when Avery was 3 years old and the family spent a lot of time in their basement under tornado warnings. They tried to explain to their scared little boy what was going on, and from then on, they said that's all he wanted to talk about. Steve said Avery could identify the model of a weather siren just by the sound it made. We have more weather radios in this house than I think they have at Best Buy, Sue added. Once he could drive, Avery chased storms in his 2005 Buick Century. He didn't really care what his car was, Sue said, just that it ran. Avery had a separate Twitter profile for his storm chasing, which featured a pinned tweet explaining he wanted to use the account to document the experiences he had while out doing what I enjoy. Steve said Avery was excited when major national news outlets picked up some footage he captured of a windstorm sweeping up dust from a dry cornfield near town. Avery's passion included more than storm chasing, though. He played the trumpet for the Cyclone Hockey Pep Band and piano. He also sang the national anthem at the Des Moines Buccaneers game, including the team's home game against the Omaha Lancers the Friday before he died. Steve and Avery couldn't skate, but he was learning. Despite that, he embraced the sport. An aunt had taken him to a Bucks game at an early age, and he was a Boston Bruins fan, too. Avery was also a counselor and lifeguard at the Ingham Okoboji Lutheran Bible Camp. Sue said he worked primarily with families who would spend a week at the camp together, helping them with activities and leading Bible studies. Being a lifeguard allowed him to continue working during the pandemic, even when the camp reduced the number of people who could attend. He'd have done it for free, given what Avery got out of the camp spiritually, Stephen said. The camp's director, Rod Quanbeck, wrote on social media that when Avery was young, he'd already touched so many lives with his continuous encouragement, love for creation, especially the skies and weather, and sharing God's love of life with others. Well done, good and faithful servant. Steve said he hopes Avery's remembered for the man of faith he was. Avery, like his father, was involved in Greek life and was a member of the Iowa State chapter of Lutheran Beta Sigma Psi fraternity. Trevor Rabdo, Avery's roommate, fellow fraternity brother, and fellow classmate in meteorology, said Avery represented the spirituality of the fraternity well. Rabjo said Avery also made notes about God having a reason and a plan for people's lives, and that he kept Bible study updates on his whiteboard. Steve said that Avery loved preaching and sharing the word. He wanted to be a scientist, and meteorology is what called him. Sue said she knew Avery's goal in meteorology was to be able to warn people of violent weather and give them the time they need to get to safety. She also said that Avery specifically wanted to be a broadcast meteorologist, having been a performer since his days in school plays, choir, and band. I think he was a natural. He loved being in front of the camera. There was too much performance in that boy to be behind the scenes, she said. Videos shared on Avery's storm-stopping Twitter account showed his work on air, the Psi's Eye on the Skies, a student-run TV weather program produced by the Iowa State student chapter of the American Meteorology Society. The chapter tweeted on Christmas, "Avery will be dearly missed around our program. He always brought laughter, energy, wherever he was, and he was emerging as a key member of our broadcast show this semester." Rabjo said Avery put his heart and soul into everything he did, setting himself apart in meteorology with his excitement and smiles. "I hope that people remember how kind he was, how much of a gentle soul he was," he said. Rabjo added that Avery also had a strong self-motivation to be a hard worker, something he hopes to carry forward in his own career and his faith. Avery was disappointed to have not been home for December's derecho, when one of many tornadoes that day touched down nearby, and Steve said storm chasers were within a mile of their home. Avery posted on Facebook, "Yes, there was a tornado north of Atlantic today, passed just to the north of my house. Of course, it was when I wasn't home, though." Like that tornado, the people who knew Avery called his life powerful, even though it was short. "Obviously, we're crushed," his father said, but we are also very proud of our son." Knowing him meant a lot, Rabdo said, adding that it's tough that he had just gotten to know Avery and now he's passed. "I wasn't expecting it to be so soon."
Classroom conversation stymied by critical race theory laws, teachers say. Melanie Hester could see her fifth graders were confused. A history lesson she was teaching about Native Americans asked the students to think about how they could honor the cultural history of the land where the United States now stands. "Where are the Native Americans now?" her students wanted to know. In the past, the Iowa City teacher would tell her class more about why Indian reservations were established, discuss the term genocide, and talk about what Native culture looks like today. This time, she held back. On her mind was a new Iowa law that restricts how schools can teach about topics like systemic racism and white privilege. "That's where I'm like, well, I'm not really sure how to answer that," Hester said. "I kind of stuck to the lesson, and if they didn't understand, I just kept moving forward, which is not best practice." Across the country, new laws targeting critical race theory are influencing the small but pivotal decisions educators like Hester make every day. How to answer a student's question, what articles to read as a class, How to prepare for a lesson. Plenty of teachers say they haven't changed their approach, and there is little evidence that these laws have led to wholesale curriculum overhauls. But in several states with new legislation, teachers say the ambiguity of the laws, plus new scrutiny from parents and administrators, are together chipping away at discussions of racism and inequality. A lot of that chilling won't happen as overtly as canceled courses, said Luke Amphlett, a high school social studies teacher in San Antonio. The real chilling effect is something that's so much harder to measure because it's these daily decisions made by educators in the classroom. 8 states now have laws restricting how schools can teach about racism and sexism, though they vary widely. All were passed in the wake of the protests for racial justice that defined 2020, a year that also saw a range of institutions acknowledge the ways they have been shaped by racism. Many school districts added anti-racism trainings, promised to review curriculum materials, or hosted class conversations about discrimination and justice. Exactly how to avoid running afoul of the laws remains fuzzy to many educators, though in part because they've been provided with little to no information from states on how the laws apply to specific teaching situations. Tennessee officials have issued no written guidance about what is and isn't allowed in class beyond the law's list of banned concepts. Iowa officials did issue guidance, but it left educators with enough questions that the state's largest teachers union has hosted several packed trainings to fill in the gaps. In Texas, emails obtained by Chalkbeat show that the state is providing little in response to questions from educators, even as districts face local challenges to curriculum materials. The Texas Education Agency did not respond to requests for comment. That's a little side note in this article. That uncertainty has left teachers and others who work in schools to freelance in a fraught climate. Joanna Estrada, a library assistant in Donna, Texas, faced a split-second decision recently while tutoring 3 elementary school students. They were reading a book about the women's suffrage movement, and the 2 girls were perturbed to learn that women weren't always allowed to vote. The boy in the group, who is Hispanic, remarked that he would have been allowed to vote. Estrada, though, pointed out that at one time, the vote was only granted to white men. The students wanted to know more details. That's where I was like, I didn't want to go too much into it, she said. Then they turned to the next story, which was about placing Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. The students wanted to know more about slavery and the Underground Railroad. I was hesitant to say something, Estrada said. I didn't want to get in trouble. Talking about slavery is not prohibited by the Texas law, and its architects have insisted that the new laws would not limit such discussions. I defy anyone to find one word of this bill that says we don't teach the ugly parts of our history, Texas Senator Brian Hughes said in August. But the bill does ban the teaching that slavery and racism are anything other than deviations from, betrayals of, or failures to live up to the authentic founding principles of the United States. That, alongside the vague requirement for objectivity, has steered teachers away from frank discussions of the past in ways that lawmakers claimed would not happen. The bill's vague and sweeping language means that they will be applied broadly and arbitrarily, warned a recent report from PEN America, a free speech advocacy group, and could cast a chilling effect over how educators and educational institutions discharge their primary obligations. Estrada's experience is not isolated. At Des Moines Lincoln High School, Stacy Smith recently found herself trying to avoid the terms systemic racism or systemic sexism while teaching a lesson about the Gilded Age. When students asked why the financiers of the time period were all white men, Schmidt redirected a question back to them. Let's talk about that. Why do you think? Other times, Schmidt has described a law's discriminatory effect or opted for terms like structural inequality. But there is something lost with those workarounds. If we don't call the thing what it is, we lose the impact of being able to directly pinpoint and then, as a result, challenge the structures that reinforce systemic racism and systemic sexism, Schmidt said. Hester, for example, fielded questions about her race from students in Iowa City whenever she wore her long hair down. Hester would turn that into a teachable moment by telling them about her background. She has black and white parents and identifies as black, and how the one-drop rule was used to classify enslaved people. Now she worries that kind of discussion could make her a target for parent complaints. These natural conversations that normally occur in my class, full of diverse students, they're very surface level now, she said. In some cases, the limits on teachers have put students of color on the spot. Ames High School junior Theo Muhammad has a teacher who calls on him to explain concepts when discussion turns to racial inequity or elaborate when she feels like she can't go into more detail. I've talked about white privilege, said Muhammad, who is a leader in the high school's Students Advocating for Civil Rights in Education Club. She'll not say it, and then I can say it. Students say that can feel like a burden, especially when the requests are directed at students of color. It puts so much more pressure on students to talk about it, said Kanaya James, an Ames High senior who is also a leader in the club. The hesitation she's seen from her teachers this year has prompted her to change up her plans for the Black History Month event she's coordinating in February. She's going to rely more on students instead. But then that also puts more pressure on students having to educate their teachers, James said. Still, a number of other educators have decided not to make any changes in response to the new laws. Skikila Smith, who teaches literature at a high school in Knoxville, Tennessee, says she can't teach the story of racial injustice in To Kill a Mockingbird without addressing her students' questions about George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and other Black Americans killed by police or vigilantes in recent years. If a student asks, I'm not going to shy away from answering, said Smith, who is black, like most of her students. I'm not going to lie when they start making connections and asking why people don't believe a black person over the lies of someone who does not look like them. My students are not dumb. This summer, Smith wrote Governor Bill Lee to ask how she's supposed to comply without abdicating her responsibility to her students. Smith said she never heard back, nor has she received a list of prohibited topics from her district. After, this is a side note, after publication of this article, a spokesperson for the governor said his office listens to constituents and the state education department is in touch with schools and educators. For now, Smith has decided to teach her students the same way she did before the law was enacted. "If this is civil disobedience, then come and get me," she said. "I will not deny my students the truth."
All right. Prosecutor, two teens ambushed teacher. Iowa pair are charged with first-degree murder. This is by David Pitt, Dateline Des Moines. The county attorney prosecuting the case of two Southeast Iowa teens charged with murder and the death of their high school Spanish teacher said in court documents they surveyed her pattern of life, ambushed her along the daily walk, and dragged her into the woods, returning later to better hide her lifeless body. Those additional details of the death of Noema Garber in early November were revealed on December 23rd, filling in the case of Jeremy Goodall, 16, of Fairfield. He is charged with murder and conspiracy to commit murder with classmate Willard Miller, also 16. Attorneys for both teens have asked a judge to move their case to juvenile court. Hearings on the request are scheduled for January 27th. In court documents filed December 23rd, Jefferson County Attorney Chauncey Moulding offered the additional details of Garber's death. Garber, 66, was reported missing November 2nd, and her remains were found later that day in a park. Authorities earlier confirmed she had suffered inflicted trauma to the head, and her body was found concealed under a tarp, wheelbarrow, and railroad ties at the Chickasaw Park in Fairfield, about 95 miles southeast of Des Moines. Authorities have not released a motive. Both teens attended Garber's Spanish class at Fairfield High School, where she had taught since 2012. Moulding argued trying Goodall as an adult is the only appropriate plan because he would be released at age 18, less than 24 months, if he is tried and convicted in juvenile court system. The prosecuting attorney cannot fathom any combination of programming at any Iowa juvenile facility which could appropriately treat or rehabilitate the defendant if adjudicated as a juvenile, said Miller. Miller's attorney has made a similar request, and Moulding resisted for many of the same reasons. Miller and Goodall are being held on $1 million cash bond in juvenile detention facilities awaiting trial. Both have pleaded not guilty. Moulding charged them as adults with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. The sentence in Iowa would be life in prison, although a 2016 Iowa Supreme Court ruling requires juveniles to have a chance of release when given life sentences.
The last article on the front page of the Metro, other vaccines aren't on GOP agenda. No push on immunization requirements for students. Iowa is among a group of about a dozen states that took action in 2021 to ban employer mandates or require exemptions for the COVID-19 vaccine. Republicans, who control both chambers of the Iowa legislature, have indicated that a push for more legislation to push back against potential coronavirus vaccine requirements is likely. But Republican leaders don't appear as eager to revisit other requirements, such as immunization requirements for students. Some groups in Iowa that are pushing back against COVID-19 vaccine requirements have also pushed for broader exemptions for childhood vaccinations and gathering more information on childhood vaccines. Across the U.S., Republicans are likely to take more steps to oppose mandates, while Democrats could try to strengthen vaccine requirements. Some national political observers say they don't expect to see it translate into a significant push to alter other vaccination requirements, like childhood immunization rules. I don't expect it to spill over into childhood immunizations and vaccinations for school, said Tim Story, CEO of the National Conference of State Legislatures. State Representative Bobby Kaufman, a Republican of Wilton, who chairs the Iowa State Government Committee, said he's looking to keep the focus on vaccine mandates narrow. I've not had a single human being approach me otherwise, Kaufman said. And Informed Choice Iowa Vice President Bree Johnson, who has helped lead the fight against COVID-19 vaccine mandates, also said she sees COVID-19 vaccine mandates as the more pressing issue. I feel like people first need to be alleviated of that, she said. You know, secure their job, keep their job, apply for a job without the medical discrimination that we're seeing happening, and exposure to their personal health information. That doesn't mean legislation couldn't appear like it has in years past. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker, a Republican of Ankeny, didn't rule out additional proposals. However, he also didn't indicate it is a high priority for Senate Republicans. I would say that the COVID vaccine shined a light on all the vaccine policy, Whitaker told the Des Moines Register in mid-December. We'll certainly take a look at that as people file different bills. But I don't have a bill in particular that I'm looking at.
All right, here's an article for anyone who likes cookies. Crumble Cookies opening in Ankeny. This comes from Sue Stapleton. Cookies bigger than the palm of your hand in unusual flavor combinations such as warm snickerdoodle cupcake, Kentucky butter cake, and sugar cookies with a Twix topping served chilled will come to Ankeny in January when Crumble Cookies opens its first store in central Iowa. The cookie shop is slated to open at 802 Southeast Oral Labor Road in Ankeny in a 1,698-square-foot space near Walmart in mid-January. Partner Bart Kuhn remembers his wife bringing home a long, slender pink box filled with four cookies that changed his life. We're both patrons first, Kuhn says of his interest in opening Crumble Cookies in central Iowa with his business partner, Rhett Anderson. Kuhn fell for the cinnamon cookie with a cream cheese frosting, while Anderson loved the red velvet with chocolate chips and cream cheese frosting. Each 5.5-ounce cookie is made fresh, using familiar ingredients such as sugar, flour, butter, and eggs. Once the cookies are baked, they're considered out of code after 2 hours and donated to charity to keep inventory fresh. That's the same everywhere in the company, Kuhn said. Everybody gets the same experience, whether it's in Des Moines or Boise. Milk chocolate chip served chilled always makes the menu. Crumble Cookie founder Cousins Jason McGowan and Sawyer Hemsley created that recipe first in Logan, Utah in 2017. A chilled pink sugar cookie regularly appears on the menu, but not all the time. The other four flavors come from a rotation of 170 recipes Crumble Cookies created over the years that changes weekly. Every week brings a new sizzle reel on the Crumble Cookies website featuring the four flavors on the menu. that Deep Cookbook of Recipes includes chilled cookies and cream milkshake with bits of Oreos on top using a sugar cookie slathered in cookies and cream icing with a sandwich cookie on top. Peach Cobbler, which combines a cinnamon oatmeal cobbler cookie with sweet peaches and a crumbly cinnamon streusel topped with a sweet cream cheese glaze. The chocolate strawberry cheesecake takes a dark chocolate cookie and fills it with strawberry cheesecake topped with a chocolate drizzle. The hot chocolate cookie, served warm, comes with marshmallows on top, while the birthday cake cookie features ice cream, cheese frosting, and sprinkles. Perhaps most interesting, a cornbread cookie topped with hot butter and honey cream that customers rank at the top among favorites, along with chocolate Oreo. The cookies come in single serving or neatly packed in pink boxes filled with 4, 6, or a dozen, each frosted and topped as they're ordered. Crumble Cookies also offers ice cream. Once open in Ankeny, the store plans to keep hours from Monday through Thursday from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. and on Friday and Saturday from 8 a.m. to midnight. Kuhn and Anderson started digging into the Des Moines area before deciding to open a franchise. "We were just blown away," Anderson says, mentioning the family values and population growth in the area. "It just seems like it was kind of this hidden gem sitting right in the Midwest." Anderson's son, Ty Anderson, known as Big Ty because he stands 6 feet 8 inches, made the move to the area to help the new store open. He plans to hire 70 people to work in the store. The Utah-based cookie purveyor plans to bring 3 shops to the metro area with stores in West Des Moines and Ames already in the works. The shop join more than 332 states nationwide. Crumble Cookies opens its first outpost in Iowa in November in Cedar Rapids.
Israel strikes Gaza after civilian is shot along the border, and this from Jerusalem. This is in the metro section. An Israeli and 3 Palestinians were wounded Wednesday in the first exchange of fire in months on the Gaza frontier. The violence came as Israel announced measures aimed at improving living conditions in the occupied West Bank after a rare meeting of top officials. Israel has announced a number of measures in recent months it said are aimed at easing tensions, but they have had little visible impact on the ground, where attacks by Israeli settlers and Palestinians are on the rise. There have been no peace talks in more than a decade. The Israeli military said a civilian near the security fence was lightly wounded by gunfire from Gaza, and that it responded with tank fire at multiple military positions manned by the Hamas militant group, which has ruled the territory since 2007. The Gaza Health Ministry said 3 Palestinians were wounded without saying if they were civilians or fighters. Earlier, Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz approved a series of measures aimed at improving relations with the Palestinians after playing host to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas at his home in Israel late Tuesday. It was the first time Abbas met an Israeli official inside the country since 2010. The 2 discussed security coordination between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, which administers pockets of the occupied West Bank. Gantz's office said he approved confidence-building measures, including the transfer of tax payments to the Palestinian Authority, the authorization of hundreds of permits for Palestinian merchants and VIPs, and approving residency status for thousands of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israel collects hundreds of millions of dollars of taxes on behalf of the PEA as part of the interim peace agreements signed in the 1990s. The tax transfers are a key source of funding for the Palestinians, but Israel has withheld funds over the PA's payment of stipends to thousands of families that had relatives killed, wounded, or imprisoned in the conflict. Israel said the payments incentivize terrorism, but the Palestinians said they provide crucial support to needy families. Israel approved residency for about 9,500 Palestinians. Israel controls the Palestinian Population Registry, and over the years, its policies have left an estimated tens of thousands of Palestinians without legal status, severely limiting their freedom of movement, even within the occupied territories. Israel granted legal status to about 4,000 Palestinians in October. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is opposed to Palestinian statehood. His government has shown no interest in reviving peace talks, but has said it wants to reduce tensions by improving living conditions in the West Bank. Recent months have seen a surge in Palestinian attacks on Israelis in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, as well as in violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank.